From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As the Gulf War escalates, so does the crackdown of the Baltic independence movements in the Soviet Union. On this edition of Fresh Air, a talk with journalist Robert Cullen about the suppression of the independence movements. The U.S. military prohibits gays and homosexuals from serving, but journalist Randy Schiltz reports that gays who are coming out to their commanding officers in the States are still being sent to the Gulf and are facing the possibility of dishonorable discharge if they survive the war. Randy Schiltz talks with us about gays and the Gulf. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers the way Americans talk about the Iraqis and the Kuwaitis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S.-Soviet summit meeting set for next month has been postponed. After a meeting with Soviet Foreign Minister Alexander Besmertnik, President Bush called off the superpower meeting. Secretary of State James Baker said today the Gulf War makes it inappropriate for the president to be away from Washington. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Today's announcement was expected. Over the weekend, the Soviet foreign minister had hinted that the summit might be put off, and White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater told reporters earlier that the Persian Gulf situation would make it difficult for the president to travel. But another important factor in today's decision, according to administration officials, is that efforts to draw up a strategic arms reduction treaty have been bogged down, and there are doubts about Soviet compliance with the conventional arms treaty signed last November. Secretary Baker.
Well, for the most part, they're technical issues. We are going to continue, and the minister and the president just agreed in the Oval Office that we would continue to try and conclude a strategic arms treaty, if possible, during the month of February. We will continue to work as hard as we can to conclude.
Foreign Minister Besmertnik said the decision was made jointly. Baker said that although the Soviet violence in the Baltic republics was discussed, the postponement had nothing to do with the military crackdown. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Military officials in Israel and Saudi Arabia say that new Scud missile attacks from Iraq have been intercepted. There were no reports of injuries in either country. It was the seventh Iraqi missile attack on Israel in the past 11 days. Army spokesman General Nachman Shai said that the U.S.-supplied Patriot anti-missile system was not used against the attack. A Saudi Army spokesman said the Scud missile was intercepted over Riyadh. Witnesses in the Saudi capital said they saw four Patriot missiles launched during the air raid alert. Some Palestinians in Jordan have found a new way to profit from Arab hero worship for Saddam Hussein. NPR's John Burnett reports from Amman.
First, it was baby Saddam. Dozens of Palestinians living in Jordan have honored the Iraqi leader by naming their newborn males after him. Now it's Scud missile jewelry as a way to commemorate Iraq's shelling of Israel, the Palestinians' enemy, for 42 years. A family of enterprising Palestinians in Amman is selling 3-inch replicas of Soviet-made Scud missiles modeled after the ones Saddam Hussein has fired at Israel and Saudi Arabia over the past 2 weeks. The ground-to-ground missiles have killed 4 Israelis, 1 Saudi, and wounded some 200 Israelis. The missile brooches and keychains were displayed at a downtown Amman souvenir shop alongside Iraqi flags, Saddam badges, and Intifada calendars. The shopkeeper said he sold 200 of the Scud pins the first day, and his cousin is now making more of them. In Amman, I'm John Burnett reporting.
The Dow Industrials lost just under 5 points today to close at 2,654. This is NPR. Thousands of refugees from Iraq crossed into Jordan today as Iraq once again began to let people through. Red Cross officials said that as many as 10,000 people have been camped for days in frigid temperatures on the Iraqi side, waiting for permission to cross. Some of the refugees who entered Jordan today claimed that a civilian refugee convoy was attacked by Allied planes as it headed north. Refugees arriving from Baghdad said that conditions there were bad, with no food, water, medicine, or electricity, and almost constant Allied bombing. In Chicago, an effort to expose alleged police brutality has gotten a boost from the international human rights organization Amnesty International. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
London-based Amnesty International has issued a report based on charges that officers in a Chicago police district routinely tortured black suspects in their custody. One alleged victim, Andrew Wilson, charged in a federal lawsuit that police coerced his confession in the killing of two Chicago policemen. Mariel Nanasi represents the group that informed Amnesty of the charges.
The medical director of the hospital serving Cook County jail inmates urged a police investigation after witnessing Andrew Wilson's injuries, which included burns to his thigh, face, and chin.
Amnesty International is not confirming that the allegations by Wilson and 20 other men are true, but the organization is asking its members to write to local and federal authorities, urging a thorough investigation. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
The Salvadoran military has reported heavy fighting with leftist rebels. The Army report said that 13 people have been killed and at least 26 wounded in 2 days of fighting. This morning, it said rebel forces attacked a northern military base. Other attacks were reported south of San Salvador, the capital city. Last week, President Bush announced he'd release more than $40 million in additional military aid to the Salvadoran government. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. While Americans have been occupied with the war in the Gulf, the Soviet Union has been using violence to suppress the independence movements in Lithuania and Latvia. And in his attempt to restore central control, Gorbachev has granted new powers to the KGB and the police. The withdrawal of freedoms in the Soviet Union is straining relations between the U.S. and the USSR. At the same time, President Bush wants to keep the Soviets in the Gulf alliance. Today, President Bush met with the Soviet Foreign Minister Alexander Bezhmertnik. They agreed to postpone the summit meeting originally planned for February until later this year. We invited journalist Robert Cullen to talk with us about the crackdown in the Baltics, its implications for the future of the Soviet Union, and for U.S.-Soviet relations. Cullen is a former Newsweek Moscow bureau chief. He's written about the Soviet Union for The New Yorker and The Atlantic, and he's now writing a book on the Soviet Empire. He last visited the Soviet Union in December. I asked him why the upcoming summit meeting was important.
There are two things about the summit that are important. One is that it symbolizes the continuation of the progress which has been made in the Soviet-American and East-West relationships over the last 5 years, that regardless of the present internal problems in the Soviet Union, that progress in the external relationships can continue. The second thing is that the summit will be the place where the two leaders will sign the strategic arms agreement, which will be, I think, a landmark in arms control and a landmark in the effort to reduce the risk of nuclear war, which is something that we have all tended to not think about for the last few years because it seems so unlikely, but which, based strictly on the arsenals, is still quite a threat.
What impact do you think the Gulf War is having on the Soviet Union now?
It's a minimal impact at this point because the Soviets realize they're in no position to do very much one way or the other. The Gorbachev-Shevardnadze leadership chose to back the United States and back the United Nations. I think that there are people in the conservative movement who would probably tend to stay away from that and tend to either tacitly back the Iraqis or take a more neutral position. But I don't think that the Gulf situation plays any significant role in any Soviet political developments at this point.
But it's playing a role in the way the United States is trying to conduct its relationship now with the Soviet Union.
It certainly is a factor in whether the Bush administration is willing to endorse serious sanctions against the Soviet Union, because I think the fear is that not so much that the Soviets would turn around and start shipping weapons and so on to Saddam Hussein, because I don't think that that's very likely, but certainly in any post-war period, if the Soviets were to return to their practice of backing the Arab intransigence and so forth, that would make it all the more difficult to conduct any effort to set up a stable Middle East.
If the gains in human rights and freedom of speech are being eroded so rapidly in the Soviet Union, does this mean that the Cold War could start up again too?
Well, it depends on how seriously they're eroded. There are a lot of things that the Soviets have done, both in their external policies and their internal policies, which we have to remember 5 years ago seemed highly unlikely and would have seemed almost impossible under the Brezhnev or Chernenko or Andropov regimes. For example, right now there are thousands of Soviet Jews leaving the country every month and going to Israel or in some cases to the United States. For example, Soviet troops are still on their way out of Germany. They have still permitted the reunification of Germany. They are still permitting the democratization in Eastern Europe to proceed. They are still negotiating seriously about dramatic reductions in strategic arms and in conventional forces in Europe. And it's, I think, important not to forget that those agreements are based largely on very one-sided concessions that the Soviets made in recent years. So I think that to say that just because they are moving into the Baltics and cracking down on separatist movements, the Cold War will resume may be premature, because the Cold War, don't forget, was predicated on things like the Soviet arms buildup, Soviet dominion over Eastern European countries, and so on. Obviously, you have to take into account what the Soviets are doing in the Baltic and internally in calculating what kind of country you're dealing with. But I think that if the Cold War ever was based on a real threat, and I think it was, then you still have to assume that that threat has substantially diminished.
But I wonder if the erosion in rights now in the Soviet Union represents a return to power of the hardline communists who waged the Cold War with the United States.
Well, it does and it doesn't. I think that it certainly represents a movement back toward power by hardline communists. But it's important to remember that they are probably not as hardline as people like Andrei Gromyko were. I spoke in Moscow last month to Yegor Ligachev, who is the kind of eminence grise of the conservatives in the Soviet Communist Party. And he said that he had no problem with defining the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan as adventurism, not something that he would want to repeat. He had no interest, he told me, in trying to reclaim or regain Soviet dominion over Eastern Europe. He did have some serious problems with the way the Soviets had precipitously allowed the reunification of Germany. He did have extremely serious problems with what he saw as a threat to the integrity of the Soviet Union by separatist movements in the republics. And he did have serious problems with the way Gorbachev has administered the economy over the last 5 years. Frankly, any sane economist would have problems with the way Gorbachev has administered the Soviet economy over the last 5 years. So I think that if you take them at their word, and I think that you have to be careful about that, but by and large, I tend to believe that if suddenly Ligachev and others of his kind absolutely usurped all the positions of power around Gorbachev and he began to do exactly what they wanted, it does not mean that they would send the army back into Eastern Europe. It does not mean that they would send the army back into Afghanistan. I don't think they can do that, and I think that the conservatives of the Ligachev stripe, at least, understand that.
Today, Soyuz, the largest newspaper in the Soviet Union, reported that if Gorbachev doesn't crack down in the Baltics, that the army could split and stop obeying the Kremlin. And there's speculation of the chance of a civil war in the Soviet Union. Do you think that there's a chance of civil war in the Soviet Union? And if so, what would the division look like?
There certainly is a chance for conflict. Whether it would spread to the extent of a civil war is not clear. I think that there are a number of factors at work. In some of the republics, particularly in the Caucasus, the Armenians and the Georgians and the Azerbaijanis are quite well armed. Over the last couple of years, they've hijacked train loads of tanks, as a matter of fact. They've gotten their hands on old Soviet artillery pieces that are now capable of firing. I was up on the Azerbaijani-Armenian border in September and saw a village that had been pretty much destroyed by artillery that was under the control of Armenian separatists. And so there is the possibility of resistance on a sort of massive level from the Transcaucasian area. The Baltic separatists are not as well armed, and I don't think that they are capable of anything more than symbolic resistance of the type we've seen this month to any effort by the Soviet army to impose its control. Where you really have a potential for conflict is if the army itself splits, as this article suggested it might. I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows, where the Soviet officer corps would come down if they were asked to shed a lot of blood in order to suppress the democratic and separatist movements in all of the republics. I think that the example of Romania suggests that some of the officers and a lot of the conscripts would find it very difficult to obey those orders. I think that's why in the last couple of years the Soviets have organized a special group within the Ministry of the Interior's armed forces, which have become known as the Black Berets. These are volunteer troops. It's not clear how many of them there are, but by virtue of being volunteers and volunteers who have gone into it knowing that their job is going to be to suppress internal disorder, one can assume that they belong to that segment of Russian society which sees the separatist movements as a threat and is eager to repress them. So that I think for the moment, given the situation in the Baltics, the Soviets have more than enough loyal armed forces to do the job of violent repression if that's what they choose to do. Whether they would have enough if the job were extended to the Russian Republic or extended to the Caucasian republics remains to be seen.
What do you think is Gorbachev's motive for repressing the independence movements in the Baltics? Do you think it represents a change of heart, a change of direction, or just something very pragmatic like his political future?
Some of both. The evidence suggests that neither Gorbachev nor any of the people close to him really understood what they were letting themselves in for when they introduced glasnost and democratization in the period from, say, 1986 to 1988. I think they really thought that the communist parties in the republics could retain the loyalty of the intellectuals and other people in the republics by being the group that was advocating these kinds of reforms. Instead, what they found was that once they were unleashed, the intellectuals and other popular groups in the republics quickly moved into a pro-independence posture, and that posture proved extremely attractive to the electorate as soon as they were able to vote in free elections. So I don't think that they went into this process of democratization on the assuming that it would lead to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. I think they assumed, in fact, that it would probably strengthen the Soviet Union, that it would make the people in the republics happier and more productive. If they did, and I believe they did, then it was a gross miscalculation. Now it's become a question of whether or not they can live with the consequence of what they've set off, which is the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And I think that if the economy were doing better, if the general social situation in the Soviet Union were more orderly and stable, and if the process in the republic seemed to be moving along gradually and with a certain minimal respect for Soviet law, then the people in the Kremlin who argue that regardless of whether we want the republics to leave or not, they have a right to leave, and if we're going to be a government of law, we have to extend that right, they might have a chance to prevail. But in the present situation where the economy is going to hell, there's a tremendous and pervasive fear of chaos and disorder at all levels of Soviet society, and where the process in the republics is developing in the direction where they fear an influx of Russian refugees if they allow the republics to continue along the road they've taken, there is very little likelihood that such liberal opinions will prevail in the Kremlin. And I think that, therefore, Gorbachev has begun listening to the conservatives who say that these are national chauvinists. They shouldn't have been given the right to speak out in the first place. They're being whipped up by foreigners, and we, as guardians of the Soviet Union, have the duty to suppress them.
Journalist Robert Cullen is my guest. He's working on a book on the Soviet Empire. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Cullen is my guest. He's a journalist, former Moscow bureau chief for Newsweek from 82 to 85. He's now working on a book on the Soviet Empire. There is the issue of, has Gorbachev chosen this time to violently suppress the independence movement in the Baltics because of the Gulf War, figuring that the world's attention will be diverted to the Gulf right now? What do you think?
Maybe in a tactical sense, in the sense that he chose to do it now instead of next month or last month. But in the broader sense, the conservative tide that is impelling him to do this has been gathering for some time and would have caused it to happen sometime around now, regardless of what was going on in the Persian Gulf.
Can you compare for us what the freedoms in the Baltics are now compared to what they were a few weeks ago before the violent suppression started in January 13th?
Well, there is still a fair amount of independent criticism and independent voices that are coming out of the Baltics. The governments are still controlled by the separatist groups which came up into being in the last few years and which won in the elections in 1989 or early in 1990. And the military has taken power and taken control of the broadcast facilities and a number of printing facilities in Lithuania. It's taken fewer steps of that sort in Latvia, although it could at any moment make more moves of that type. So that what you have, in effect, is a sort of standoff where the threat of force, at least, has not caused the Baltic peoples to submit. And they can't, by virtue of the political means at their disposal, force Moscow to grant them their independence. So it's an unstable standoff, but at the moment what you have is a standoff.
Do you think it could still go either way at this point, or do you think the independence movement is finished?
I think in the medium to long run, and by that I mean anywhere from 3 years on to 10 or 20, the independence movements will prevail. I think in the short run, and by that I mean anywhere from the next 6 months to the next 3 or 4 years, they won't. I think that a period of repression is at hand and that in one form or another, they're going to be repressed for a while. I think that it may well be that the period of reform that Gorbachev initiated has run its course, and as has happened in the past in Russia and in the Soviet Union, you're in for a period of conservative retrenchment. But I think that there is a critical mass of people, educated people, members of the Soviet elite, who understand now and can't be dissuaded from the fact that, A, the old ideology, the communist ideology, it just isn't going to work, and B, that anything that takes its place that will work will have to have a certain amount of freedom and free expression. And I think that the next wave of reformers, whenever they come along, probably will start from the assumption that any successful reform is going to have to operate from the assumption that some of the republics are going to have to be given their independence.
What's at stake for the Soviet Union here? Why is it so important for the Soviet Union in their eyes to prevent the independence movement from getting any further?
Well, if you talk to Soviets about this, almost invariably they start arguing that they can no more afford to allow a Lithuania to secede from the Soviet Union than the United States could allow Texas to secede if, say, the Mexican-American population of Texas voted that they wanted to rejoin Mexico or become independent. And while their argument is imprecise and their analogies have a lot of flaws, at the root of it, I think, is their belief that a great power tends to be a multinational enterprise to which, by either persuasion or force, is capable of holding to it a variety of lesser nations. And I think they fear that if they allow the process of disintegration to begin, they will lose their stature as a great power. And in addition to that, there's no telling where that process of disintegration will end once it starts. The Soviet Union is in many respects like one of those Matryoshka dolls, which you may have seen, the nesting dolls that are made out of wood. You start taking the biggest one apart, and then there's a smaller one, but you can take that apart, and pretty soon you get down to a little kernel. And if you look at Russian history, back in the 14th century, Moscow was a little kernel of land, maybe no bigger than Rhode Island. And over centuries, it's accrued all this enormous territory. But there are still people on those territories who can look back on history and say, wait, you know, back in the 17th century, Siberia belonged to the Yevanky people and these other people that are similar to the Eskimos, say. So now we want Siberia back. The Ukrainians can look at the Ukraine and say, I'm sorry, back in the 16th century, the Ukraine was independent and we want it back. And Russia could be left with a very small nucleus of territory, really. So I think that they have this sense that the process of disintegration, once it starts, may not be easy to stop. And it could leave Russia being a very small and inconsequential country.
Can you give us a sense of what it was like internally until, you know, a few weeks ago in the independence movement in Lithuania? What kind of controversy, what kind of dissension was there within the movement itself?
Well, Lithuania was a very depressed state when I was there in December. The people, I think, had the sense that they were like somebody who had dreamed for years and years of buying a grand piano and filling their house with music, finally got the money together and bought the grand piano and then discovered that they would have to learn how to play it before they could hear any music. They were disappointed that their democracy and their independent government had not produced real independence. They were disappointed at the state of their economy. And I think they were feeling that a repressive wave from Moscow was inevitable. Still, when you compare it to the situation the Baltics were in 5 or 6 years ago, the first time I visited them, they were incomparably better off in terms of freedom and the right to speak out and a sense that they were masters in their own house.
Do you think that the crackdown on the independence movement could have been avoided if the independence movement in the Baltics played their hand a little differently?
Well, it's very difficult to say, but I would have played the hand differently, and I think that there is at least the chance that it could have been handled differently. I think that there's a good case to be made that they should have played along with the law on secession that was passed in the Soviet Union early in 1990, which required them to hold a referendum on secession as a first step in the process of leaving the country. And that would have, I think, given Gorbachev some cover in that it would have enabled him to say, look, they're acting in accordance with a law that the Supreme Soviet passed, not I. And therefore, as chief executor of the laws, I have the obligation to allow them to do that. As it happened, they basically chose to defy his authority and make it a question of whether he was going to enforce the laws or not. And I think that was a fundamental mistake.
America had so embraced Gorbachev and his reforms, and I guess you could say the world did too. I mean, after all, he won the Nobel Peace Prize just a few months before starting the crackdown in the Baltics. I wonder if you're personally saddened by this or if you kind of expected it as a possibility.
It's very saddening and disheartening to see what's going on now. You can read history and see that it's probably something to be expected and something that will pass in time. But I think of a lot of friends of mine in the Soviet Union who have found new opportunities and flourished in ways that they could not have dreamed of doing 6 or 7 years ago. And the thought that that will be taken away from them and that the chance for Russia to become a modern, liberal, civilized country will be put off for any number of years, that to me is very saddening, very disheartening.
Robert Cullen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Robert Cullen has written about the Soviet Union for The Atlantic and The New Yorker. He's now writing a book on the Soviet Empire. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There are probably thousands of gays and lesbians stationed in the Gulf, although U.S. military policy prohibits gays from serving. Coming up, a talk with journalist Randy Schiltz about the military's official and unofficial policies toward gays and lesbians. He says some gays and lesbians who are coming out to their commanding officers in the States are being sent to the Gulf with the threat of dishonorable discharge when the war is over. Also, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg comments on how the language we use to describe the Middle East reveals the preconceptions we hold. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is quoted as saying that his country's Scud missiles have nuclear, chemical, and biological capability. The Iraqi president is quoted in an interview with CNN correspondent Peter Arnett in Baghdad as saying that he could not predict how long the Persian Gulf War will last, but he said lots of blood will be shed on every side. Saddam also charged that those he called hypocritical Western politicians had convinced him last fall that if he let the hostages leave, they would keep the peace. One Iraqi Scud missile was launched at Israel tonight. It apparently self-destructed, and debris fell in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Linda Gradstein reports from Tel Aviv.
It was the seventh missile attack in Israel since the beginning of the Gulf War. But for the first time, debris from the missile fell on Palestinian towns and villages in the West Bank, as well as in Israel. The army spokesman said no Patriot missiles were fired. It is not clear if the Patriots could determine that the missile had self-destructed or if a decision was made not to fire them. Israeli observers said the fact that only one Scud missile was fired made some in the defense establishment fear that it could be a chemical attack, but it was later determined that the warhead was conventional. Defense Minister Moshe Aaron said it is still not clear if Iraq has the ability to put chemical warheads on Scud missiles, but he said Israel should be prepared for such an attack. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Tel Aviv.
And a Scud missile was fired at Saudi Arabia Monday night, but it was intercepted by a Patriot missile and debris landed at a farm outside the Saudi capital. An Iranian official at the UN says that some of the Iraqi pilots who flew to Iran this weekend were, in his words, trying to save their lives. He also repeated a promise that Iran would impound the airplanes after the war is over. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Allied officials say at least 69 Iraqi aircraft, including some of the country's best fighter planes, have flown to Iran in recent days. Why they made the trip has been something of a mystery. U.S. officials have speculated that Iraq may be trying to hide its best aircraft from relentless bombing by Allied forces. Today, Iran's U.N. ambassador, Kamal Karazi, told reporters it seems that some of the Iraqi pilots were going to save their lives and their aircraft. He did not elaborate. Iranian officials have already indicated that a few of the incoming planes had crash-landed. Karazi said the pilots were being interrogated. He delivered a letter to U.N. Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar today promising that the planes would remain in Iran until the fighting ends. He also said Iran remains neutral in this conflict. At the U.N., this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 5 points to close at 2,654.46. This is NPR News. A U.S.-Soviet summit meeting in Moscow has been postponed until later this year. Secretary of State James Baker says because of the Persian Gulf War, it would not be appropriate for President Bush to be out of the country. And also, he said, there are still issues to be worked out in a treaty to cut long-range nuclear weapons. Both sides say the idea to postpone a summit meeting until later in the first half of the year was mutual. There was no mention about Bush administration concerns about the Soviet crackdown in the Baltics. The Kennedy Space Center halted work briefly today to remember a somber anniversary. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE has more.
A moment of silence was observed this morning at the Kennedy Space Center as NASA workers remembered the fifth anniversary of the Challenger disaster. NASA grew silent for 73 seconds, the amount of time that the mission lasted before Challenger erupted into a ball of fire. That event grounded the shuttle program for 2 years and resulted in the implementation of numerous safety guidelines for all future shuttle flights. 5 years later, the space agency is still under fire for safety precautions and its many technical glitches. This last year saw a nearsighted telescope and several fuel leaks, resulting in launch delays. Today, NASA no longer flies secret military missions, and it is still waiting for the shuttle Endeavour to come off of its California assembly line. Endeavour was ordered to replace Challenger 5 years ago. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
An Air Force F-16 fighter crashed in Nevada today during a training mission, but the pilot bailed out and he was not injured. The airplane went down in a desert area about 75 miles north of Las Vegas. According to news reports in Bulgaria, the government has decided to free most prices starting the first of the month. This is expected to lead to price increases averaging about 500%. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The U.S. military has a policy that states homosexuality is incompatible with military service. Gays are prohibited from serving. But journalist Randy Schiltz reports that some men and women who are coming out to their commanding officers in the States are still being sent to the war in the Gulf. What will happen to them if and when they return is being questioned by gay rights advocates. Schiltz is working on a book on gays in the military. He's the national correspondent at the San Francisco Chronicle, where for many years he did groundbreaking coverage of the AIDS epidemic. He wrote the first comprehensive history of AIDS called And the Band Played On. Schiltz has conducted over 150 interviews with military personnel. I asked him what's happening now to gays in the military who are coming out.
What's interesting is that normally, once any branch of the military, once the commanding officer finds out you're gay, normally they move very quickly to kick people out. But that's not the situation now. There have been at least 15 cases I know of where reservists who want to go to the Gulf but don't want to go over there and end up getting in a situation where they'll be court-martialed and potentially thrown into prison, that they're going to their commanding officers and say, well, I want you to know before I go that I'm lesbian or I'm gay. And so the response of the commanders generally has been, well, that's all right, we'll take you anyway, and then maybe we'll kick you out when you get back. And some commanders are saying, that's fine, I don't care. One woman who was in a hospital unit in the Midwest went to her commanding officer and said, well, I want to go, but you should know that I'm lesbian. And the commander said, well, that's fine. If we didn't have lesbians in the hospital corps, we wouldn't have a hospital corps. And so there's a lot of situations where, because they need these people, because a lot of lesbians and gay men are some of the better qualified and have some of the highest performance rating, that the gay regulation is unofficially being overlooked.
But there's this fear that it will be overlooked during the war, and then whoever survives the war and is gay and lesbian might face, what, a dishonorable discharge upon returning home?
Exactly. I mean, historically, if you look at both World War II and Vietnam, the military in those cases were ready to overlook the fact that somebody might be gay because they needed warm bodies to send to the arena. What's different today in 1991 than in those previous wars is that now we have an organized gay movement. And I think what is the groundwork because of the military responding this way, very unofficially, I have to add, the Pentagon denies that this is happening, but it simply is happening. The Pentagon, by doing this, is laying the groundwork for, I think, much more aggressive challenges to the exclusion of gay people from the armed forces.
Rennie, can you explain why the people who you've spoken to, I think you said there were about 15 people who recently came out, why are they choosing now to come out to their commanders?
Well, I think that they're making, as you look ahead to going to a situation where you might get killed, they're beginning to make some ultimate decisions. And I know one woman, the woman Donna Lynn Jackson, who came out and did this publicly at a hospital unit that was based in Fort Ord here in California. Her statement was that she didn't want to die in the closet. On the whole, these people are they don't come into the military with a political agenda. These people are Marines first or Army people first before, that's their priority before being gay. And I think that the fact that you know, a lot of these reservists, when they signed up, I don't think very many of them actually thought that they're going to go anywhere and get shot at. But now that they're facing that, they're saying, well, I don't want to have to hide it. Also, you've got to keep in mind that what gay people who are in the military face, That I think that there's those of us in the civilian world, you know, we know that they kick people out of the military, but I think we tend to think that they sort of take you by the hand and politely show you the door and courteously suggest that maybe you should seek employment elsewhere. And that's not the case. The fact is that what these reservists and the military people are facing, especially as they go into a war situation where they may be more easily discovered, that you've got to remember the military still throws people in prison for being gay.
What is the punishment if you're discovered to be gay in the military?
Okay, there are two different areas in which the military responds. First, there is an administrative area. There is a regulation, Department of Defense Regulation 1332.14, which is the regulation that bans gay people from the military. Now, you violate that regulation by thinking homosexual thoughts. All you have to do is have a propensity to be gay or have an intent to someday commit homosexual acts, and you violate this regulation. Now, for that, if you violate that, that does not have any criminal penalties, obviously. You would be subject to an administrative separation. Nevertheless, it's punitive in as much as if you're kicked out under this regulation, very often you get a less than honorable discharge. You don't get the benefits. You lose your job, first of all, that by being kicked out of the military, and that it could make it very difficult, if not impossible, to get jobs in areas of expertise for which many people are trained in the military. So that's one area of punishment. The other area of punishment is if you violate the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ. Article 25 of the UCMJ, Article 125, makes any homosexual act, any and every homosexual act, punishable by 5 years in prison. So that this is where people are getting sent off to Fort Leavenworth for years of hard labor, that even if you have, you know, sex with your lover, a consenting adult in the privacy of your own home off base, every time you have sex, you can be put in prison for 5 years. And there are every branch of the military, each and every year, throws a few people into prison for being gay, the net effect of which is just mainly to scare the bejesus out of everybody else. So that when the military cracks down and has one of its massive purges at a base, that they'll get people to turn other people in order with the threat that they'll go to prison if they don't.
Randy Schultz is my guest, and he's the national correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. For years, he was America's foremost reporter on AIDS, and he wrote the book And the Band Played On, which was a study of AIDS. But since April, he's been researching gays in the military, and that's the subject of a forthcoming book that he's writing now. Let's get back to the gays who are coming out to their commanders in the States before getting sent overseas to serve in the Gulf. And in the cases where the commanders say, well, we're going to send you over anyways, what are the gays and lesbians who have come out saying in response?
Mostly they're saying, fine, we'll go. There have been a couple situations where they've had trepidations over the idea that they're going to go and get shot at in the Gulf and then come back here, and rather than receiving the gratitude of a patriotic nation, they're going to be receiving a dishonorable discharge because they're gay. And so some people have contemplated going public, one reservist has, but on the whole, most of these people are being shipped off. And I think that this policy reflects something else that's very interesting, too, about what's going on. If there's anything that's been fascinating in terms of my research into this book, it's the extent to which a number of commanders and high-ranking people in the military today have no enthusiasm for kicking gay people out of the military. It's very interesting to see that there, you know, among people up into the general officer level, into the generals and admirals, that there are a number of very, very high-ranking people now who do not think that gay people should be kicked out of the military. They don't say this publicly. They don't hold news conferences saying this. But I've heard story after story of gay people going to their commanding officers, and when a situation has come up where perhaps someone has turned them in as homosexual or something, and the CO's ripping up the statement that the person has signed it when they were turned in by someone else and things, there is not a unanimous support for these regulations in the military anymore.
I'm wondering if you've heard of instances where heterosexuals are claiming to be gay as a way to get out of serving in the Gulf.
Now, I haven't heard of this. Now, this is sort of an ongoing problem that the military faces, and I think it could be a severe problem for the military, particularly if they try to restart the military draft. The way the regulation is written, now this is not the UCMJ, but the regulatory, the administrative part of this gay regulation, that you, as I've said, you don't really need to ever have sex with someone of the same gender in order to be kicked out for being gay. All you have to do is state that you are gay or indicate that you may have an intent to commit a homosexual act in the very unspecified future. So I think what happens is if the selective service system is geared up again and we look ahead to having a draft, it's going to be virtually impossible to have a meaningful national conscription because I think you're going to have a lot of people just to, if you get anything resembling a strong anti-war movement on the campuses, I think you're going to get a significant number of college students just saying, well, I'm gay. You know, they'll just say gay and they'll be out of the draft. And I think once you do that, I think you could get a domino effect because other people are going to say, well, why are they getting out?
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Randy Schultz. He's national correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle and had been really the country's foremost reporter on AIDS. He's the author of the book And the Band Played On. But since April, he's been researching gays in the military. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Randy Schultz is my guest, the national correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's in the process of writing a book on gays in the military. From the interviews that you've done so far with gays and lesbians in the military, do you have any impressions of what life is like for gays and lesbians in the Gulf? Have you been able to glean that at all?
Well, it's interesting. I was in Jacksonville, North Carolina a couple weeks ago, and in the gay bar that's literally across the street from Camp Lejeune, which is one of the nation's major Marine bases, every Friday night, all the guys who had friends in the Gulf were bringing down their letters, and everybody would read everybody else's letters. And, in fact, a number of gay Marines from Camp Lejeune, using a computer in the Gulf, or a military computer, have started now putting together a newsletter for gay people from Camp Lejeune, which is being reproduced in Jacksonville, North Carolina, and then sent back to everybody's friends who are gay in the Gulf. So there's a huge network of gay people over there. In fact, I was just in San Diego yesterday, and the gay church there, the Metropolitan Community Church, estimates that it's got between 50 and 75 parishioners from that one church alone who are now serving in the Gulf. On the whole, I mean, most of these people are being, you know, working night and day just like all the other soldiers in terms of doing their soldier work. And most of their letters read an awful lot like the letters that you'd read in People magazine in terms of their concerns about, whether or not they'll get killed and whether or not that they'll die in some horrible, grisly way in this war. So a lot of that is the same. I think what's different is just that their fears about being discovered. I was talking to a woman yesterday in San Diego whose lover is serving in a reserve unit in the Gulf now. And so when she writes her letters, if she says anything that expresses any affection, like I really miss you and I love you, she can't sign her name, she just can sign her initial, because military censors can read these letters, and if they see a same-sex name, then that could lead to action, which could, you know, land her lover in jail. That people have to make up code words if they talk about, you know, very often people will say, if they're thinking of, how they want to kiss somebody, they'll say, I'm thinking of, I'd really like some peanut butter, which means I'd like to kiss you or something. And they have to make up all these elaborate code words so they don't get found out. Another woman whose lover is serving in the Gulf in a Southern California-based reserve unit, what she does is make audio tapes to send to her lover. And what she does is write a letter and then has a male friend read the letter into the audio tape so that it doesn't sound like it's coming from somebody of the same sex. And then they send the audio tape to the Gulf region so that, again, the woman, the lesbian who's serving there won't get found out.
Are there differences between what gay men and what lesbians face in the military?
It's very striking, the differences. First of all, women are kicked out at a per capita rate 3 times higher for being gay than men are. Clearly, these regulations are being enforced much, much more strongly against women. It's my sort of from my preliminary research indicates that the reason this is because the gay regulation is being used in 2 ways. First of all, to root out women who are sort of threatening men by taking non-traditional jobs and going into institutions which traditionally have not had women in them, so that women who are, say, mechanics or doing things that are traditionally male jobs are under much greater suspicion of being gay and therefore much more likely to be kicked out. I think the second way in which these regulations bear down on women and which they don't bear down on men is I think the most depressing way, which is sexual harassment. The fact is that the gay regulation, as it's used against women, is a tool for sexual harassment of women. Routinely, I've heard this story again and again and again. Women who do not put out for men are accused of being lesbians. The cliche is either you're a whore or a lesbian if you're a woman that's in the military. What's most startling is that again and again and again, I've heard stories of men who are trying to get women to have sex with them, and they literally say, if you don't have sex with me, I'm going to turn you in as a lesbian. And that happens all the time, and often it's very successful, because if a woman goes to her commander, and again, I've got numerous instances of where this has happened, if a woman goes to her commander and says, this guy is trying to hit on me, and he's threatening to turn me in as a lesbian, the commander will usually respond not by investigating the man who is guilty of sexual harassment, but they'll usually respond by investigating the woman to see if she really is a lesbian. And I think that that's the most depressing way.
Do you think that the Gulf War will result in any challenges to the gay and lesbian policy of the military?
Oh, I think it's inevitable. There have to be tens of thousands of lesbians and gay men serving there. Undoubtedly, some of them, as soon as they get back, will be put up for discharges. And I think what's going to be different from this war than in Vietnam or other wars is that these people are going to fight them. So I think it's inevitable that these regulations will fall in time and decades. But I think that this probably will accelerate the process, because I think most Americans tend to be pretty fair-minded, and they really won't cotton to these people who've served their country and risked their lives and then be kicked out for a reason that has nothing to do with their performance or their patriotism.
Randy Schultz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Randy Schultz is the national correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's working on a book on gays in the military. We called the Pentagon to ask about Schultz's charges that homosexuals in the armed forces are knowingly being sent by the military to the war in the Gulf, but could face a dishonorable discharge when they return. No one was available to speak with us on the air, but a representative in the press office denied the charge and sent us a statement that says, military members who claim homosexuality will be neither processed for deployment nor deployed. They will be expeditiously processed for discharge and separated. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We have news today about the postponement of the Gorbachev-Bush summit, something which both the Soviet foreign minister, Bezmyernik, and Secretary of State Baker both said was something that their bosses were interested in doing. It's, of course, wrapped up not only in the controversy in the Gulf, but also with the crackdown in the Baltic republics, and also with the general toughening up of the Kremlin on Soviet society, new powers for the KGB and the army that have been announced over the past few days. We'll also have the latest news from and about the Persian Gulf, including a talk with an expert on Iran about what all those planes might be doing there from Iraq.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the past couple of weeks, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has noticed TV newscasters referring to the residents of Baghdad as Baghdadis. This has made him think about how we use the suffix E, the suffix which is spelt with the letter I.
You won't find Baghdadi in any English dictionary, but I suppose it sounds natural to add that E suffix to the name of a city in that part of the world. It seems to form a pattern with Iraqi, Kuwaiti, Saudi, Israeli, Pakistani, Bengali, and the rest. Still, this is a curious thing for English to do. We have a lot of suffixes that make adjectives out of the names of places, but most of them aren't restricted to a particular part of the world. So we say Japanese, Sudanese, and Portuguese, or Irish, Polish, and Turkish. But the suffix E is only used for nations and regions that lie in the territory that stretches from the Bible lands in the west to India in the east. Of course, it isn't used for all the countries and regions in that area. For one thing, we only attach E to the names of places that end in consonants, like Iraq and Kuwait. And there are some countries in the region where another suffix is used. People from Iran are Iranians, and people from Afghanistan are Afghans, though you sometimes hear Afghani and Irani as well. Of course, the immediate reason why the suffix E is used for nations in this part of the world is that it comes from the languages spoken there. In Semitic languages like Arabic and Hebrew, the suffix E is a way of forming adjectives out of nouns. It's like the English suffix ish in words like Polish, boyish, or fiendish. The suffix E was borrowed from Arabic into Persian, and from there into Urdu, the language of Pakistan. These are both unrelated to Arabic. They're Indo-European tongues that are distant cousins of English. It's from Urdu that we get words like Pakistani, Punjabi, and Kashmiri. Still, this doesn't explain why we choose to refer to these particular nationalities with a suffix taken from their native languages. Why should we say Iraqi when we don't say Italiano or Ruski or Nicaraguense? But a couple of hundred years of colonial involvement have given English speakers a special relationship with this region. The English use of the suffix E began in the 19th century in India, in words like Bengali and Punjabi. Most likely it started with British soldiers and colonial administrators who wanted to display a smattering of the local language to show they were old India hands. Names like Iraqi and Saudi first appeared in English after the First World War, when these nations were carved out of the former Ottoman Empire. The name Iraq itself was taken from an archaic Arabic name for Babylon. Here, too, the use of the suffix implied an intimacy with the local culture, at a time when T.E. Lawrence and Rudolph Valentino had turned the Arab into a figure of high romance. By the 1940s, the suffix had become a marker of Near Eastern origin. When the State of Israel was founded, the word Israeli replaced the old form Israelite, though, of course, we still use Israelite to refer to the inhabitants of the ancient nation of Israel. And around the same time, the old word Yemenite was dropped in favor of the word Yemeni. The suffix E draws a kind of line in the sand. It circumscribes the region that Europeans used to refer to as the Orient before that term was transferred to the Far East. But as Edward Said has pointed out, the Orient was a European invention. It's been imagined and reimagined by Napoleon and Delacroix, by Disraeli and Kipling, by John Foster Dulles and Steven Spielberg. It's painted as a place of despots and assassins, sages and mystics. It's languid and voluptuous. It's fanatical and puritanical. But it's always the Orient, a single idea that blurs the vast differences in culture, history, and language that the region actually encompasses. In its own small way, the suffix E contributes to the illusion. It doesn't just make Middle Easterners exotic. It makes them all exotic in the same dusky way.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was directed by Roberta Shurrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we survey African-American perspectives on the war, and we'll consider what's at stake in the Gulf War for the haves and the have-nots of the Middle East. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.